Good morning, everyone. Let us call the meeting of the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability to order, and would the clerk please call the roll.
Representative Burke. Representative Davidsmeyer. Senator Kaler.
Here.
Representative Pritchard.
Here.
Representative Riley. Senator Rose. Senator Sims. Senator Staines. Senator Severson. Senator Tracy. Representative Wheeler.
As you can tell, we're short on members, so what we're going to do is call our agenda item for motions and open the roll, and members will vote as they come in. So we have a motion to approve the group insurance contracts being renewed or amended for FY 2019. Does someone wish to make that motion? Go ahead. So it's been moved to approve the proposed renewal amended versions of the following contracts for FY 2019. Blue Advantage, HMO, HMO Illinois, Health Alliance, HMO, Aetna, HMO, Aetna OAP, HealthLink OAP, CVS Caremark, and Minnesota Life. It's been moved and seconded. And let's start the roll call.
All of them. Senator Kaler.
Aye.
Representative Pritchard.
Yes.
Senator Staines.
And we will leave the roll open as members come in and are able to vote this morning. Let us begin our agenda with an overview of the FY 2019 Group Insurance Program. Would the CMS panel please come forward along with Mornay Chappelle? Go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
Richard, members of the commission. My name is Tim Dutton, and I am the acting director of the United States of March 2nd.
Is the microphone on?
No, the green. Yeah.
Much better.
Yes.
Okay. So my name is Tim McDevitt. I have been acting director of CMS since March 2nd. I'm joined today by members of my senior staff, including my deputy director of our Bureau of Benefits, Teresa Flesch. So I'm just going to be brief today and then open it up for questions. I would note that the Bureau of Benefits has achieved significant savings over the past year. So these include initiatives related to dependent eligibility verification, which has saved over $28 million. $56 million in savings that was achieved through a competitive procurement for a new PPO vendor and the associated provider savings of lower rates through that procurement. Over $3 million in vision benefits and $27 million in savings associated with our pharmacy benefits manager. We continue to look for other opportunities to both improve service to our members as well as to achieve better savings for taxpayers. With that, I will open it up to questions from the commission.
Members have questions? So according to the Benefits Choice book that you've provided for FY19, there will be no rate increase or plan changes as compared with what was previously proposed by the administration. Is that correct?
That is correct, subject to any acceptance of legislation that is currently in the Senate, which would potentially allow implementation of a group of plans that would be very similar to what is in the administration's last and best offer, as made to AFSCME. If that legislation were passed, we would, depending on the timing, either have a special enrollment period very early in FY 2019 or extend the benefit choice period to accommodate that. But at the moment, the reason that you don't see any changes, even if you look at the premium dollar amounts, and this is similar to previous years, as the Commission is probably aware that those amounts are exactly the same, is because that's something that is subject to bargaining. And since we're not at the table right now, those dollar amounts are fixed.
So you're waiting for legislation. Would a court decision also alter your plans going forward?
That's correct. So it would depend on the timing, certainly, right? It's very hard to control, A, you know, what the outcome is, and B, the timing of that outcome. So currently the impasse litigation sits in the appellate court. I would expect that whichever side lost would appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. So that might take, you know, us well to the end of the calendar year before we would have any clarity on that issue, which is one of the reasons why this legislation exists, to provide that clarification, legislatively speaking, to expedite any implementation of the last and best offer.
So there's no plans, according to the book, of moving to the metal bands of benefits this until we have some resolution, as you've mentioned. Would you then open up for another enrollment period if that were the case?
Yes, that would be the expectation.
So what is the current amount of claims backlog, and how long have vendors been waiting to be paid?
Current backlog is about $1.6 billion, and current hold cycle is 8 to 9 months.
So that's an average amount?
That's an average amount. It varies a little bit between our self-insured and fully insured, but it's close. They're all within that range.
Okay. So some people seem to report that they've been waiting well over a year, and I just wondered if you are focusing on some of those long delays, and what might they expect for resolution?
I'll let Colin Brewer speak to this. He's our chief financial officer for benefits. I would note, you know, there is a distinction there to be made also with the interest associated with some of these. So the interest has been waiting certainly a longer period of time than that, but the underlying principles generally fall within the time frame that I outlined. Do you want to speak to that, Colin?
Sure. My name's Colin Brewer. I'm the CFO for the Bureau of Benefits at CMS.
Good morning.
And to address your question regarding possibly hearing from constituents waiting for payments, or from providers waiting for payments for an amount of time longer than the director indicated, what you have to keep in mind is that when we talk about our hold cycles for our self-insured programs, that is from the point where we receive a clean claim from a provider. It may take several weeks. If it's a complicated bill, it may take the course of a couple months for a bill to even come to our vendors before we get an opportunity to look at. And some large bills may require an extended amount of review if they're large or complex procedures. So when we discuss 9 months, it's from when we get a bill. But if somebody's waiting, as they say, for up to a year, there's other time periods involved in the process that could delay their payment from the date of service to when they actually get paid.
So what steps are being made to help speed up the resolution of a clean claim?
Well, I can answer this briefly, but we do have many different performance guarantees within the contracts that we have with our self-insured third-party administrators, where they're required to process X percent of all claims within a certain amount of days, and we hold them to those standards to ensure that they are processing as quickly as possible. When it comes to very, very large claims, I think it's probably ultimately in everybody's best interest to take a little bit of time and make sure that the claims that are being paid out to providers by the taxpayers are actually correct and accurate.
And how much is currently owed in interest?
Let's see. For the amount that the state has, as of March 31st, there's about $41 million of interest that we have yet to process and provide to the comptroller for payment.
Okay, and that's on all of the health care claims?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the outlook for 2019 if a budget is not approved? Looking at the scenario that we had a few years ago, will CMS need a new appropriation authority to continue to pay vendors and provide employees with insurance?
Yes, I would expect we would. You know, alternatively, you know, we saw the qualified purchasers and the use of third-party financing during the impasse, so there could be utilization of that at a greater level as there was during the impasse. But I think, you know, in a perfect scenario, I think all of us would prefer a situation where there wasn't a third party and there wasn't an interest payment. Instead, we had benefits being provided under a scenario in which we're directly paying the claims.
Okay. And would the clerk please note that Representative Davis Meyer has joined us? When do you need to leave? Okay. So you've also used an online portal that we talked about last year. Has the transition to that online portal gone more smoothly, and do we have any issues with that?
Yes, yeah, so I believe you're referring to the Morneau-Chapelle portal. So issues continue occasionally to arise, just with little discrepancies here and there in numbers related to, you know, perhaps a payroll deduction, other things of that sort, different reports. We continue to make progress, and as you might imagine, given there are well over 20 payroll systems that interact with our group insurance, and several of these are what you might consider more autonomous entities in a sense, right? Not only other branches of government and other constitutionals, but also universities with their own sort of practices in place. And so that coordination challenge, I think, for anyone that was coming in to handle this sort of work would be a challenge. So we address issues as they come up, but you know, we've made considerable progress over the past year.
Okay. Are you aware of any employee complaints?
We occasionally will, you know, receive just little notes about a discrepancy here and there. And, you know, I think a lot of the complaints that we heard in previous years related to some sort of denial of service due to some confusion of whether or not someone was in fact still enrolled in their plan. We're not seeing that.
Okay. Other questions? Go ahead.
Good morning. It's great to see you and welcome in your new role, Director. Just a couple of follow-up questions to Representative Pritchard. How much right now, I think you had said there's $1.6 billion in backlog and bills, averaging around 89 months. Do you know how much has been financed through the vendor program, the vendor support initiative, that since it's been put in place of the group health insurance?
I'll let Colm speak to that, and it depends on what time frame we're talking about, right? Because, you know, we have some that's been financed years back, but Colm, do you want to speak to that?
I could get you a further detail breakout if you'd like. The numbers that I have right here are cumulative for the entire program's history. For the group insurance program, our vendors have sold just under $3.2 billion worth of principal. Of that, just under $2.8 billion has been repaid through the QP process, and there's an additional $400 million that is still outstanding as part of the backlog we discussed a minute ago.
And do you know, so that 3.2 is all principal?
Yes.
And do you know how much has been paid out in interest?
We have accrued, based on those bills that have been paid, not counting the bills that are still around and are going to continue to actually accrue more interest, but for those other bills, there's $428 million in total We have processed $414 million of payment vouchers to the comptroller for payment to the QPs. Some of that is still outstanding. A good majority of that is outstanding at the comptroller at this time.
Okay, so $428 million in interest payment, late penalty in interest payments. That's correct?
$428 accrued to date, yes.
To date, okay.
And to be clear, most of that is sitting at the comptroller. So as of last numbers I had from last week, for FY18, there were over $360 million that's at the comptroller. So we've processed it, but it is there, and that's on prompt pay.
But once the underlying principal's been paid, it does not accrue any additional interest.
That is correct.
So that seems it's been a strategy that's been getting used by the comptrollers paying off the principal to make sure we're at least not accruing more interest payments?
Yes, that's the strategy that's being employed.
And, you know, and are vendors currently expecting that there'll be a lot more takers in the program on a going forward basis? Is there any sense of, have you done any estimation of how it's going to be used going forward?
So, and I think what you're saying is, you know, will there be appetite from the qualified purchasers to continue to provide this sort of financing?
Yes.
Frankly, we're hearing some concerns that there will begin to be less appetite, and the reason for that is as follows. As you just alluded to, after the 90-day period, prompt pay begins to be incurred, but then once the underlying principal is paid off, the interest itself does not accrue interest on interest, so to speak, right? And one can understand that we want to avoid additional costs to the taxpayers and why the comptroller would thus attack the principal, so to speak, first. That said, if you're a financer of this program, if you're buying these receivables, you need a return on your investment, ultimately, that is better than what you could get elsewhere in the marketplace, right? And there's some concern, I believe, amongst our qualified purchasers, and I'll let them speak for this, because they can articulate their concerns better than I can, that if those interest claims continue to not be paid, at some point it will no longer be a good financial option for them to be qualified purchasers.
How many vendors do we have in the program right now?
We have four. Three out of the four provide most of the funding.
And I know in the past the commission has received a monthly breakdown of the purchases by vendor, but it has not. I think it's been a few months at least since the commission has received that. Is there a plan to start producing that again?
We can certainly provide you with that, and would be happy to do so.
That would be welcome. Okay, I think that's it for my questions. Thanks, Representative Pritchett.
Other members have any questions? Yes.
So along those lines, you said once the principal's paid off, interest is not accrued on the interest. Is interest accrued on interest while the principal goes unpaid, or is there just no interest on any of that?
No interest on interest, just interest on the principal.
Mm-hmm. So is there a plan to look at the interest payments and bring them up to date? Because obviously those providers are not accruing interest on the interest, so there is, I can understand the state is not energized to respond to that. So what is the plan to help these businesses catch up on what is owed them?
So we have certainly on our end processed and sent that to the comptroller, and I understand she has a delicate dance of how she balances competing priorities. And she acknowledged that, frankly, last week in her own appropriation testimony, that on the one hand, paying providers of human services is a very high priority, and also saving the taxpayers money by paying off the underlying principals is a very high priority. But at some point, the fact that these programs, these qualified purchasers, have helped sustain the state through challenging financial times. And ultimately, to just look at them in isolation is to ignore the fact that they are the financing and helping ensure continuity of services that are health and safety services that are ultimately essential. And so I think there does have to be a delicate balance between both, you know, managing the state's finances in a responsible fashion, prioritizing vendors that are health and safety vendors, and at some point, you know, giving enough of a return to sustain interest in this program, which will then ultimately ensure that those health and safety services continue to be provided and financed.
I think we would all agree with that, and that's why there is some urgency to try to get that interest paid.
Yeah.
Seeing no other questions, thank you very much, Acting Director McDevitt.
Thank you.
And please feel free to contact us if you have other issues and concerns.
Thank you.
Would the panel of the Vendor Support Initiative Payment Program please come forward? Yes, we have an ongoing role on a motion to approve the group insurance contracts being renewed or amended for 2019, and you would vote?
I'll vote yes.
Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. Please introduce yourself and offer any testimony you'd like to make.
Chairman Staines and Pritchard, members of the Commission and staff, thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Brian Hines, and I'm the founder of Vendor Assistance Program LLC, or VAP. We're proud to have been the first qualified purchaser in the state's vendor payment program, and today remain the largest. To date, we've purchased from, or we've assisted over 1,000 vendors in Illinois, and we purchased slightly over $4 billion of Illinois receivables. About $3.2 billion is through the Vendor Payment Program, Vendor Support Initiative. An additional $800 million are just direct contractual relationships with vendors, but that didn't qualify for either of the programs. As it relates to HERF, we've purchased a little over $2.6 billion of HERF receivables. We've been paid a little over $2.2 billion back, so today we currently have outstanding $376 million. Total PPP, or penalties paid to us, since 2010 is a little over $65 million. Total penalty owed to us today is a little over $250 million. And with that, I pass it along and open to any questions.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here. My name is Gregory Gack. I'm a co-founder and officer of Illinois Financing Partners. We are a qualified purchaser in the state of Illinois. I testified here last year, as you may recall. Starting in 2015, we've purchased more than $1 billion, or nearly $1 billion in invoices. The HMO that we've been able to help provides coverage to more than 80,000 state employees and their dependents, and we're proud to be of assistance in that program. Last year, when I was here, we had purchased $600 million in the previous 2 years, and I was asked if we could purchase another $600 million over the next 2 years, and I told the members of this commission that yes, we could, provided that we saw some payments, not even regularly, just periodically. A lot has happened in the past year. No payments were made during the budget impasse, and we saw that lenders were starting to back away. Most of our funds are provided from outside lenders. We have our own capital at risk as well. IFP was contacted by vendors whose qualified purchasers could no longer fund the purchase of those vendors' invoices. And IFP itself was down to a single lender at one point before the budget impasse was lifted. Then, of course, the stopgap budget was completed, and $6 billion of bonds were issued, and we started receiving payments. Starting in September, we received one payment of $43 million, and then in November, we received about $600 million more for a total of about $640 million of payments before the end of last year. And then in February and March, we received another $149 million of payments, most recently as March 29th. Since this meeting last year, the total prompt payment penalties that we've received have been $0. Let me repeat that. We've received no prompt payment penalties in the last year at all. Last year, we also began a program with healthcare providers on the Timely Pay program, partially in response to comments that we received here that there were providers who were talking about moving out of districts with large numbers of state employees because they weren't being paid in a timely basis. We expect that program to reach $100 million shortly, and we'll continue to expand that program to the extent we can. Historically, the timely pay interest had always been covered, paid by the state within about 30 days, as is the statutory requirement. Suddenly, starting in November, we stopped receiving timely pay interest. And since November, we haven't received any, some of which is now coming close to 6 months past the 30-day interval during which it's supposed to be paid. In its conversation with the state, we've always been clear that there can be no discrimination between the qualified purchasers and the vendors who have not sold their invoices, with the rare exception that if a vendor's in financial distress, we understand that certain payments may be paid out of sequence. The regularity of prompt payment penalty payments is important if the vendor payment program is to continue. Currently, we are owed about $115 million in prompt payment penalties. While these prompt payment penalties remain unpaid, we continue to have to pay interest to our lenders, and this money goes out of state. More than half of what we receive in prompt payment penalties gets reinvested here in Illinois with the vendors. Every day that drags on, we have less and less money to put into the program and less money that we can put back to the vendors who are owed the funds from us. We are under financial stress from the long delays in the prompt payment penalties. We believe that since the full PPP is vouchered, we should be seeing some payments soon. We remain committed to working with the state of Illinois, but we are stressed, and if the state arbitrarily and without explanation continues to change the mechanics of the prompt payment penalty and timely payment penalty, we have a very difficult time explaining to our lender partners what the problem is, what the future holds, and how we can continue to move ahead in this program. So thank you very much for the opportunity to address you again, and we certainly look forward to your questions.
Good morning, committee. Thanks for having us here. My name is...
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for...
One moment, sorry. Please. Would the clerk please note that Senator Rose has also joined us, and we have an open roll on the motion to approve the group insurance contracts, renewing and amending them for 2019, and how would you vote? Thank you. Please proceed.
Hello, my name is Nirav Berry. I am the CEO and co-founder of PayPlant. We've been a qualified purchaser since 2013. And we've purchased to date about $130 million worth of invoices. Currently outstanding are about $100 million. We've purchased lots of invoices, and to date we've received prompt pay penalty interest on one invoice. So pretty close to the experience my colleague expressed. Practically no interest has been received.
Good morning. My name is Lee Chen. I'm the CEO of Vendor Capital Finance. We have purchased to date just about $520 million of invoices. We've been paid down probably just over $400 million, awaiting payment on another 100 or so. We haven't, while we have gotten prompt payment penalty in the past, I would say prior to September of 2017, we haven't received any since. We have about, I'd say about $26-27 million outstanding. The note that I would make with in regard to Greg's comments about lenders, that it's very difficult to explain to folks that who are loaning you money why there is a delay when the program lays out sort of reasonable terms and statute, oh, not statute, but terms and expectations on that payment. If we get to a point where there's another budget impasse and liquidity is sought, there may be less interest, I'd say, in terms of providing liquidity to the state for the vendor payment program and the vendor support initiative.
So have you relayed your concerns to CMS, and what response have you had?
We have laid out our concerns rather explicitly with CMS, and we've had many conversations with CMS. CMS has told us that our interest has been vouchered and that the vouchers continue to be paid in sequence. The issue is that we have not seen any interest at all coming from the state.
Okay. So all of you are in arrears since last December, or?
No, actually, in terms of HERF, there have been no HERF payments made since last April for penalty. And with the pay down in November, there now have been 24 months of regular monthly payments made for the underlying vouchers with no interest payments made.
Yeah, our concern is simply that we're working very well with the state, and we're proud to provide a service for the state, but we essentially get slapped in the face when we get paid the base invoice amounts of the vouchers when there are hundreds of millions of dollars of prompt payment penalties due. We understand the economics from one perspective, that is, there is no interest being paid on the prompt payment penalties that are past due, and there is interest that's accruing on the outstanding invoices. However, fundamentally, it will kill the program, and it absolutely precludes our ability to fund the program, because, as I said, we take a lot of funds from the capital markets and from larger lenders, and they all look the same. They all look at us and wonder, how can we continue without actually having any economic return?
Yes.
So at this point in time, if something doesn't change in terms of the way the payments are happening, I'd love to understand if any of your companies do anticipate purchasing any more liabilities from other vendors with the state.
We at this point have a plan in place, and we have commitments in place to maintain our activities in the timely pay program directly with healthcare providers. It's a much smaller program than what we have in prompt payment penalties, and we think that we are able to capitalize on some commitments that we have in place to continue with the prompt payment penalties. But every conversation that I've had with our lenders over the last month, and even we received an email Friday asking about the status of the prompt payment program, indicates that there are lenders who are extremely concerned. We were actually told by one of our lenders during the budget impasse that we could not draw any funds until the stopgap budget was passed. So I can't speak definitively on that point, but I can say it's highly likely that literally on a moment's notice we could be notified that there's no more interest in purchasing and funding our purchases of invoices.
And I agree with that assessment. The conversations with the lenders are getting more and more difficult each week.
Is that the similar situation for your two companies as well?
We're newer to the healthcare invoices, so we're not there yet, but I can predict that if this continues, we'll get there too. So at the moment, we don't have investor pressure.
Yeah, we would agree that you'd see diminished interest in providing liquidity to the state.
Okay. I just want to make sure, too, see if any of the vendors, this is just a standard question we usually ask, if any of you have a pending regulatory issue with any state agency or under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other state Attorney General's office. Just can you speak up if you do? Does anybody have any issue? Terrific. Okay, understand the nature of the concern. So, and this only has recently come to my attention, so appreciate understanding more from your perspective.
Well, thank you. I have described it to CMS as stepping off a cliff. you know, you don't really know that there's nothing underneath you until it's too late.
You know, and it's one thing about what the concern is for your companies. I think bigger issue is what does that mean for the vendors who have been participating in this program and their willingness to go forward with the state. I imagine that you guys are not in a position to be speaking in an intelligent fashion about how those other vendors are feeling about it. Would that be fair?
So kind of two ways to answer the question. One, for the larger vendors, you know, they do own part of this penalty too, so they're owed money also. But as I said, we've purchased from every agency in the state of Illinois going back to 2010. In a lot of situations, the smaller vendors, in the basic vendor payment program, we only advance 90%. That's the way the program is set up. And then the vendor ends up waiting for the penalty. So, again, it's not HERF, but the smaller vendors of the state of Illinois are also waiting for their 10% holdback going back years. And it's absolutely a strain on them also.
I would just add to that. So we do the same. We work with a lot of the smaller vendors as well. And the general belief now is they don't expect the remaining 10% because it hasn't come for years. So now they believe that they're just going to get that 90% up front.
Oh, that you think that they've just written off that
they
final 10% holdback?
They've given up, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So, Brian, you said you guys got into this pretty early in the program, correct?
Yes, we actually started before the program.
We
started in 2010, and the vendor payment program came around 2012.
Okay, so can you kind of lay out your experience from start to finish? I mean, initially, what were the payments looking like when you were receiving the payment for the actual principal? Were you receiving prompt payments on interest, and where's it gone from then?
Sure. Each agency was a little bit different. On HERF with CMS, the payment was regularly maybe a month after the underlying invoice was paid. Some agencies lasted a little longer, but you know, at the longest prior to the budget impasse, the longest I think we faced was just a few months. And now in some situations some agencies were facing a few years, and as it relates to HERF, it's been over a year since a penalty payment has been made.
Okay. Have any of you looked into taking any legal action?
It has been looked at, yes.
Okay.
I don't think anything is imminent, at least from our standpoint.
Yeah. Nobody wants to have to do that. Hurt relationships, I understand, but. Thank you.
Previously, the commission received a monthly breakdown of the vendor payment purchases by vendor. This information has not come to us in recent months. Is there anticipation that we will receive those reports again?
I believe from the earlier testimony that the CMS said they would provide that, yes.
Right. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Yes, one further.
Actually, do any of you have recommendations or suggestions for changes to the program and the way it's being structured right now that might, make, I mean, obviously you want to get the interest payments, I understand that, but are there other changes besides that, getting the interest payments made, that you would have for us?
We all may, if I can just begin. Obviously, the first thing is interest, right? So as CMS indicated, the hold cycle has gone down from 28 months down to 8 months. So any kind of relief of even making the next month, instead of making a normal month's payment, pay down some of the interest would go a long way with us and with our lenders. As it relates to the program, there are actually several bills that have been introduced that are proceeding, and we've been in communication with the comptroller staff on those, because in particular 2058, Senate Bill 20. Yes.
Yeah, we're regularly in communication with CMS on administrative details as it relates to adjusting the documentation in the program and other legal nuances. On a major level, certainly the overwhelming concern is the payment of the prompt payment penalty. One of the items that may enhance it would be to include in the prompt payment legislation a timetable for the payment of the prompt payment penalty. Right now, we have such a thing in the timely pay program. That's the one to healthcare providers, where it has to be paid within 30 days. And until November, we saw that going on. But in our conversations with lenders, they ask, "Well, when are you going to receive the prompt payment penalty?" So we have to go back historically, which we do, VAP has done it as well. We go back historically and look at what the turnover has been, how quickly it comes in, and we use that. And then, of course, when it doesn't happen, it's egg in our face. So any sort of legislative remedy like that would be helpful. The other is to take a light touch in amending the program. Every time legislation is introduced, the world knows about it, of course, and we have to respond to legislation that's being negotiated within this chamber, and that requires us to address concerns of lenders and other stakeholders as to whether or not we're going to see a reduction of a rate down to 6% or something like that, as opposed to the current 1% per month. So that sort of thing is a bit of a distraction for us, but in the end it tends not to hurt us.
Do you think any trade-off in terms of setting a timetable for paying the interest penalty payments coupled with a reduction in that 1% per month could be valuable?
I think in the future it could. The major risk that we assume, in addition to, of course, the credit risk of the state of Illinois, is the timing of the payment. Imagine going to a bank and saying, "I'd like to borrow some money," and of course the bank says, "When are you going to pay it back?" And you know, we say, "Well, when we get it." It's a very interesting conversation. So a lot of the interest that we accrue and have to pay out to our lenders comes from the fact that we just don't know when the payments are going to come in. You know, for a while, they were steadily, I think as CMS described, about 9 months past due, and they're back to that now. But then suddenly they can be two and a half years past due. So we have to borrow money for an indefinite period of time, and that's expensive. So I would say once we can achieve regularity, and if we can achieve some legislative solution to the timing of the prompt payment penalty payments, then maybe there's room for reduction. However, during the budget impasse, we actually saw the opposite effect when the 1% per month was an insufficient rate to cover a lot of vendors in the state.
All right. Thank you.
There's no other questions. Yes, go ahead.
I might add a couple more suggestions. Some sort of incentive to pay the prompt payment, maybe interest on the interest or some kind of timeline for which it's paid. We've also seen some procedural hurdles. For example, the vendors can now opt to be paid electronically, but the qualified purchasers can only be paid by a check. So once we're looking at large checks that, even a day that the check takes to arrive to us can mean a large amount of interest. The other procedural hurdle is when you look at invoices where you have lots of small invoices, the system can take a long time. So there's some processing roadblocks in terms of how many invoices can be processed.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Mr. Davis Byron.
Really quick, since you mentioned the smaller invoices, when you receive payment, how clear is it which invoices you are getting paid on? I know that some of my smaller vendors, when they get paid directly, they have trouble juggling trying to figure out what invoice they're actually paying. Do you guys have a similar issue?
We have come across situations where most of the time it's very clear, it's a one-to-one, but sometimes there's this multi. Mm. Where they pay multiple invoices with one payment, and it's very hard to figure out which. So what the vendors are doing now is they're saying, "Well, we're just not going to finance those."
So if they're paying one invoice, obviously it's pretty clear. But
correct.
If they're lumping it all into one payment, you kind of have to juggle around and
correct.
Figure out which ones they're covering. Okay, thank you.
There are no other questions. Thank you very much. And thank you for your patience. So we went past Mano Chappelle. If there's a representative here. morning.
Good morning.
I'm Kerry McKenzie. I'm a partner with Mourner Chappelle. Mourner Chappelle provide the technology and some services around the insurance program.
So it's our understanding that a lot of the transition problems have been resolved. Is everything in your assessment working smoothly? Employees are able to communicate any issues and resolve them quickly?
So everything isn't exactly perfect, as the director mentioned earlier, so we still have a few kinks that we are working through. In the majority of the cases, we're providing the services that are required. Most people are able to enroll and get access to the services that they need. In the instances where that's not possible, we have mechanisms and processes in place to rectify those quickly. But we are much further ahead than where we were last year. I would say we're pretty close to being stable or operating in steady state.
So what percent of the employees would you say are using the portal as opposed to the phone or other means of communication?
It differs by different groups, but I'd say the majority. I would say maybe more than 60% of the folks visit the portal for different things. There's some groups that are still pretty comfortable talking to someone to get through their enrollments, so we have processes to facilitate that. But the majority of the employees that we would have expected at this juncture to be using the website is going through the website.
Mm-hmm. Other questions from the committee? Mr. David Smyer?
So are you seeing newer employees coming in, going directly into that and not worrying about phone calls and things of that sort, going directly to?
Well, so typical to most of our other customers, you'd see earlier entrants into the workforce are more comfortable with technology, so that's where they'll go first. But we do see some folks that you wouldn't expect to be online taking advantage of those services. I believe as we refine the program a little bit over time and put things in place to force that behavioral change and push people to the website, which is what I think we want to do ultimately, they will. As long as you have the facility for them to call someone, that most will probably still do that. But we're seeing, compared to other organizations similar to yours or even private entities, the level of traction that we would expect to see in the second year of existence, especially since we've worked through some of the challenges we've had in prior years and there's a bit more trust with the technology and the information that's out there. We're seeing the progression that we'd expect at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? No other questions. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We now have several panels that are going to be responding to the renewal and amended contracts for FY19. So the first panel would be our HMOs. So would Blue Cross, Health Alliance, and Aetna please come to the table? So we're just dealing with the HMOs at this point. Okay, would you proceed? Who wants to begin?
I'll go ahead. Robert Miller from Blue Cross Blue Shield, representing the HMO Illinois and Blue Advantage HMO plans. We have a premium funded arrangement with the state. We are participating in the VSI program, and we're prepared to move forward with any different benefit plans if the CMS office so directs us to do that.
Okay.
I'm Frank D'Antonio, market president for Aetna. I am responsible for the Aetna HMO, previously known as Coventry. The Aetna OAP plan, previously known as Coventry, the Quality Choice Healthcare Plan, which was formerly with Cigna, and the Medicare Advantage plan. which is still known as Coventry. We are responsible for and accountable to over 92,000 state employees and their dependents. And I have no knowledge of any pending litigation.
Good morning. My name is Sinead Rice Madigan. I'm Vice President for Government Business and Customer Solutions for Health Alliance. We've been privileged to be a vendor for the state of Illinois for health insurance for nearly 40 years. We also participate in the vendor payment program with several of the vendors over several years. We appreciate the value that they bring to the state of Illinois in supporting financing the health care for our taxpayers and our employees. Health Alliance has no litigation before it at this time, no AG investigations. We have had 21 Department of Insurance complaints and zero on the Medicare Advantage side.
So we'll ask a question that was much debated last year. Have there been problems in the transition to the portal system? And have you incurred additional costs due to the overtime and other expenses during this transition?
This is Sinead with Health Alliance, and we've worked closely with both state CMS and Morneau-Chapelle's team through the last 18 months to 2 years on the transition. And to Mr. McKenzie's point, there have been bumps in the road, but we have worked through those and are prepared for the upcoming benefits choice period, whether it be with the metal tiers or with the existing benefit design that's in the booklet today.
Same from Blue Cross standpoint. We do work closely with the CMS office and Morneau-Chapelle on any issues, concerns, or ongoing feeds of data, and we're working very strongly with them. And again, we're prepared to move forward with whatever benefit plans happen for the next enrollment period.
Same answer for Aetna. I do want to go back to the previous statement. Vendor assistance plan, we do work with VCF. Been a very good partner with us. We've received about $100 million in payments since December of 16, and we're working on a transaction over another $50 million.
Have there been any issues where providers are asking for payments up front, even since we've started to have a budget?
So for the, I would think it's the same for all of us as HMOs. We're a fully insured product, so our contracts are such that we are not, I mean, we're trying very much not to incur timely payment interest to the providers directly, so we are not holding payments to our providers. We are using the VPP program and other mechanisms to ensure that we're paying our providers timely and don't have the potential issues that you might be seeing on the self-funded side from that perspective.
And I would concur on the fully insured HMO, same, since we work with VCF to collect the premiums. We are hearing, and I talked last year and I believe the year before to this committee about the potential of what will start happening with providers not wanting to participate or not wanting to see state of Illinois employees or their family members. And my commentary last session was around Medicare and how that would impact network adequacy. But what we are now starting to see, as my colleague mentioned, on the self-funded side, we are starting to see, so for the OAP plan and the Quality Choice plan, we are starting to see and hear issues from providers that either don't want to participate or are at minimum complaining about timeliness of payment.
Go ahead. Questions of members?
I'm just wondering, has anyone actually pulled out? Providers stopped taking state employees?
To this date, as of my knowledge, no. I'm not aware of any.
From a Blue Cross standpoint, since we're a premium HMO, we pay our providers the same as any other member. They don't know if they're a state of Illinois member or not. So no providers have pulled out because of our relationship with the state.
Are there other questions?
For anybody participating in the VSI, are you concerned about not being able to sell some of that off?
I would echo the same concerns that you just heard. At some point, we're going to step off a cliff, and there's going to be no parachute or no safety net for us. So I do worry about that. So to your question of any thoughts on improvements, short of getting timely and making the payments, it's going to be a difficult road.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our next panel will be OAPs, Aetna, and HealthLink. And would the clerk note that Senator Severson is joining us? And we have an open roll on our motion to renew the contracts for 2019. Would you like to vote on that? Votes affirmatively. Thank you. Okay, please proceed with your testimony about the OAPs.
Good morning. My name is Susan Laney. I am with the manager of HealthLink. I have been on the state plan since 2001, so for 17 years. We have approximately 73,000 members, and we continue to work with our providers and continue to talk to our members and help our members get through the difficult time. We do have providers that are refusing to see State of Illinois members. We call them and ask them to reconsider, and we work with CMS to try to help that situation. We have some providers that are seeing only current patients and not new patients. But again, we continue to work with CMS and the member, and then we look for other alternatives for them as well during this period of time.
So as previously stated, we have over 92,000 State of Illinois employees and their dependents that we serve. The majority, though, of the individuals that we are responsible for and to are on the self-funded, the OAP plan, about 23,000, a little over 23,000, and on the Quality Choice plan, over 54,000. So when we are receiving the payments on the fully insured side, we're able to satisfy and work with the providers in a timely fashion. We are backlogged till June of 17 on our self-funded plans. The majority of that now is related to the Quality Choice plan, obviously, because that's where the majority of the membership is today.
A question of this panel. Senator Severson.
The backlog's been improved, obviously, over the last year, hasn't it?
Yes.
So have you seen a lessening of a frustration?
Historically, the answer would be yes for Aetna, I'll say globally, with what our offerings were to the state. So prior to June or July of 17, we weren't really offered in the city of Chicago, around the city of Chicago, more on the outline and rest of the state. When we brought on the Quality Choice plan, there is a large percentage of that population that's in and around Chicago, and that's where we're hearing the most noise from now.
Okay. And for both of you, are those does this work differently than it does for your local government health plan? Is that separate?
Yes, it is separate and paid separately, yes.
Okay. And similar contracts, or are those current? And
they are the same contracts. So we do have providers that will indicate that they will see the local and the trip, you know, and that they will take new patients from that. We actually reach out to them indicating you are being paid current with those, and they do accept those.
Okay. And how are the funding or the losses, do you know how they're running for local government plans? And we hear rates are going up on those. Do you track that at all?
We track as far as the membership coming in and the membership that we've lost. The municipalities have a unique arrangement because they can go in and out. So we do have some municipalities that may choose to go to a different vendor, and then a lot of times they'll come back as well.
Okay. And those are tiered plans based on the health of the group?
Even though they're small groups,
they still qualify for rate tiers based on their own loss history?
From the self-funded perspective, we don't get involved in the rates. That's actually done at the local level, and then they provide us with the information as far as the benefit structure, so we don't get involved with the premium perspective.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we move to life insurance.
Yes, because they said... Because they said the level was supposed to be from CMS or CVS did not come.
Okay.
We might want to ask.
Is there anyone here from CVS? We were told that there would be no one here, so we'll move on then to Minnesota Life with our life insurance program.
They told CMS this morning they were going to be here, I guess.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for letting me up here to testify. Am I too loud?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you, Commission and Chairman Pritchard. My name is Michael Yee. I'm the account manager for Minnesota Life, and we've served the state since 2001. Presently, we cover 200,000 state members and retirees. We have roughly about 45% participation in the optional life program, which means we cover about 90,000 members and retirees on the optional life. Since we've served the state, we've paid claims in an average of 2 to 3 days, and none of that changed or was disrupted even during the budget impasse. And I'm sure you'll be curious to know we have no officers or senior management under investigation.
Good. Is there any issue with payment of claims? The Treasurer has encouraged legislation that deals with payment of claims from beneficiaries that couldn't be identified. Is there efforts by the company to pursue eligible beneficiaries?
Absolutely. So when there's no designation on file, we follow the order that's specified in the policy with the state. So we follow the progression between, you know, kids, parents, siblings, and ultimately we do have databases that we search to find family members. So these are services that we pay for to locate family members. If all of this is exhausted and there's no beneficiary found, we then escheat the funds to the states.
Questions of members? Go ahead, Senator.
So I think I heard you say that about 45% of employees and retirees buy the optional life insurance.
Yes.
How does that compare to other states? Is that sort of on track? Is that typical?
Typically around 50 to 60% would be on the high side. We have clients all over the board, but ideally one doesn't want any more than 60% because then you start getting anti-selection. But so the state is a healthy, enrollment in the optional.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no other questions, thank you very much for providing the service.
Thank you.
We'll then next move into the ongoing health contracts for 2019 and bring forth a panel with Aetna on the Quality Care Health Plan.
Frank D'Antonio again, representing Aetna.
Yes.
We have, as previously stated, over 54,000 state employees and dependents on the Quality Choice Plan. And we're about $235 million in arrears going back to June of 17. The majority of that's going to be associated with the Quality Choice Plan because basically the membership is double what it is in the OAP plan.
Have you been seeing any increase in the number of vendors that are looking for payments up front from the client?
I can tell you that we're hearing a lot of noise around specifically this population. As previously mentioned, where we didn't have the same geography that we covered, we didn't have these issues as much with the providers. We were able to work with the provider community because a good part of our membership was covered by the vendor assistance program, so we were good there. And a number of those providers also saw the self-funded OAP providers as well. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to hear that, and we're also starting to get a lot of pushback from providers that potentially they may leave the network, which would cause us a network adequacy issue. Not so much on the Quality Choice Plan. I really worry about that on the Medicare side for the retirees is where I really worry about that.
So those, it would be primarily retirees, wouldn't it, that would be on the Medicare
Correct.
Beneficiary?
And Correct.
So the providers are pulling back from insuring on retirees?
Well, what I'm what I'm worried about is the domino effect. So if on the actives, whether they're OAP actives under the self-funded plan or Quality Choice actives under the which is self-funded as well. Remember, on the fully insured side for the HMO, we work with VCF. Everything works really well there. So we're timely paying providers. But on the self-funded side, what potentially could start happening is they say, okay, well, wait a minute. This is a state of Illinois member that was inactive, now has moved into the Medicare world, and there's different rules around network adequacy and participation on Medicare. So it only really takes one or two physicians in key areas that could create a network adequacy gap for the Medicare product. So that's my concern as a domino effect happens as it relates to the retirees that are on Medicare.
So have there been any difficulties with the transition from Cigna to your management of this program?
Challenges. We had some difficulties just making sure systems operate and integrate, but we've worked through those. I will say that we're not perfect. Everything's not perfect, but we strive towards making it perfect.
Okay. Questions of members? Ms. Everson?
In contracting with more and more providers going to integrated systems, is that contracting issue becoming less of a problem because you're contracting with that integrated system as opposed to the individual doctors?
From the standpoint that it's one contract that'll cover broad number of providers, yes, it's less difficult. The intricacies of doing the contracting, though, in a bigger system come down to the system that was existing that purchased another system, which contract prevails and where were the rates on those. And I'll tell you what my worry is from that standpoint is where we start seeing the more metropolitan systems start to pick up those critical care hospitals that are in more of the outlying areas, the more rural. My worry is then basically what the metropolitan hospitals are going to want is to raise the fee schedules for those critical care hospitals. Or at some point they're going to say not affordable to keep them open. So that to me, again, going back to the domino kind of effect is what I worry about there.
And do you, with your contracts with your doctors, do you, if they take some of your products, do they have to take all of them, or do you allow them to cherry pick which products they can contract you with?
The overall answer on that is no. So if they're going to participate with us on the on our active membership or our commercial membership, they're going to be in all products unless they specifically say we don't want to be in this. On the other side of that, we also have to offer the opportunity for all the providers to be in all of our products as well. So how we contract is all payer, all product. On the Medicare side, there's a potential that they could say, I want to be in commercial but not Medicare.
Is that their choice or is that your choice?
It overall is going to be their choice. The only times that it'll be our choice is if they don't pass credentialing. Those sorts of requirements.
But you you don't have the ability to say if you're going to be in our commercial contract, you're also going to be part of our Medicare contract?
We like to move them that way, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So there's been a lot of concern about rising drug and health care costs. What new innovations have you brought to the table to try to help stabilize those rates of increase?
Well, obviously with our contracting, and one of the goals we have as Aetna is to have 75% of our medical spend, whether it's fully insured or self-funded, through what we call value-based contracts. And what value-based contracts are just changing from traditional fee-for-service, where we pay each time a member sees or a patient sees a provider, to more quality-based. And what we're aiming for is we're aiming for a few things. We're aiming for improved quality, improved access, and obviously decreased cost. So we have been undertaking this effort for many years now. And so that's one way. The other thing that we've been really been focused on as Aetna historically is what we call social determinants. And it really comes down to it's not so much your genetic makeup of what your potential is for lifespan and quality of life. It comes down to almost the zip code or even the city block you live on. That impacts the different sorts of programs that you get or the impact on safety issues on you, your own person. So kind of imagine for a minute if you had to make the choice between paying for your heat or your rent and taking prescription drugs. Imagine if you were in a home that you had a procedure done, and maybe you had some sort of durable medical equipment and needed a wheelchair. But where you live maybe is on the fourth floor of a building, so we can get you back home from the hospital to your apartment, but we can't get you down the stairs to go to your next appointment. So what we've been doing is we've been working with local social organizations, also expanding our medical management department to start including and having our nurses go to people's homes to be able to identify and recognize all these sorts of issues. Because while I can come back to you and say, hey, we did what we were supposed to do to the letter of the contract, people were admitted to the hospital, had their procedure, they went home. What's the rest of our social responsibility after that? If basically what happens then is, since they can't go to their follow-up visit, or they can't take their prescriptions, or they, you know, aren't able to get their durable medical equipment, what's our social responsibility for them, and what's the cost related to that when they can't do that?
Okay. Yes, Senator?
So do you do that through case managers that manage the patients, and how long have you been doing this, and is that really a thrust of how you are determining quality of care?
We've basically always been doing some form of this case management over the years. What we're starting to shift to, as opposed to being, I'll say, phone-based, we're being community-based, where we had all of our case managers that would be in the office and then make their phone calls every day and work with the members, and we had really good success that way. Now what we're shifting to is we're shifting to the nurses not being in the office, but being in the people's homes every day and working with the members. And it doesn't have to just be in the members' home. Sometimes what will happen is a member's going to their doctor's appointment, so it may be easier for our case manager to meet that individual at the doctor's office to go through and actually act as an advocate during that visit as well.
So do you coordinate this with the physicians?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's all about the coordination and the collaboration.
And are you seeing a return on that?
Historically, what we've seen is upwards of a 5% return on that investment, and we're about at the same 3 to 5 today as well.
Thank you.
Are you getting cooperation from the client to participate in what the physician has recommended or the drug regime? What techniques are you using that might improve that beyond 5%?
Yeah, so I would say that it's growing. The participation is starting to grow. Where we have the most success is when we jointly work with the employer group. So where we make the outreach to the member, and it's not on behalf, like the envelope or the call isn't just Aetna, it's on behalf of us representing you as the state of Illinois, because now all of a sudden the trust factor is going to be there. So who's this insurance company calling me when they've been in the state of Illinois plan for the last 30 years? They don't know anything about who Aetna is or Blue Cross or those sorts of things, because they think they're in the state of Illinois plan. So when we jointly present that way, we've had a lot of effectiveness. Where we've also found and we're able to get people into the programs earlier is through all the wellness initiatives that we've had across the state, where our wellness team has been at all the different facilities, north, south, east, and west, across the state, doing health fairs and those sorts of things, where we can hopefully find somebody that isn't what we call your frequent flyer, you know, your high-cost person, well before those sorts of things happen. And the other way we do this, too, is by... This is going to be a difficult term given the day and age we're in, but mining data, claims data, to kind of see what where the members are and what kind of conditions that they have, because they could have a $100 or $200 claim, or they could be taking a $100 or $200 prescription drug, and those sorts of things could be the precursor to a lot bigger issues. So. Working with the PBM vendors, working internally with our providers and externally with the external providers, that's how we identify these and try to get ahead of them.
You mentioned frequent flyers. Are you working with local emergency service providers as well as the nurses you may have that make those home visits to avoid trips to the hospital and emergency room?
Absolutely. That's the whole goal, is to... See, I believe our business is contrary to most other businesses, products, and services. In our business, the more you get isn't necessarily better quality or better for you. The longer you're in a hospital isn't necessarily better for you. So what we want to do as much as possible is keep people healthy and happy and productive outside of the hospital. So any which way we can avoid those sorts of things, that's what we're going to try and employ, and that's where the case managers come in very strategically.
But are you using the emergency service providers, EMTs, if you will, more in certain areas of the state to provide that in-home check and hopefully... avoid transporting to the hospital?
What we have done in certain communities is not use the emergency services, but potentially Ubers or different sorts of medical transports to make sure that people are getting to their doctor's appointments. And again, how we identify those sorts of things is when we do the home visit or we do the discharge planning when people are leaving a hospital or facility, to know what their capabilities are. Kind of goes back to the example I was given about someone living on the fourth floor. if they can't get out of their apartment, they obviously don't have the transportation to get to, you know, their follow-up visits.
So have you seen an increase in problems with transportation? People not able to get to the doctor or to the other services that might be necessary?
We're starting to see more of a resolve in that as we're working with the social agencies and the different organizations. So I think we're headed the right way from that standpoint. It's not where we would all want it, but it's starting to head the right way.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Severson.
Sure, a couple. The population you're talking about is a little bit different than the Medicaid population, where transportation becomes more of a problem, even though I have been reading about more communities that are integrating triage nurses in some of these calls, and where they can use a Uber or Lyft versus an ambulance, then they can do that, mm-hmm. which is a significant savings as well.
Mm-hmm.
On the wellness side, on your contracts here, it's probably not the same as in the private sector. Are you allowed to implement any kind of negative incentives for outcomes? The reason I say that, in the private sector, they'll implement penalties. If you don't do your wellness exam every year, you pay $50 a month more for your health insurance. Or if you don't do certain things, there's negative incentives. Because the problem with wellness programs is, as you know, the only people who do the wellness programs are the ones that were going to do it anyways.
Right.
So it doesn't really change outcomes, which is why a lot of carriers have moved away from heavily incentivizing wellness programs, instead implementing more negative incentives. Now, the private sector is doing that, but are you allowed to implement those, or those all have to be negotiated with labor before you can do those?
So you're correct on the private sector. Me as an Aetna employee, we do have different sorts of carrots and sticks that are available for us with the amount that we pay potentially for our coverage, but also then just the different sorts of wellness programs that we can take advantage of. And you are correct. Overall, with typically the people who do, but what we're starting to see, this is, from my estimation, very hopeful, as we're starting to see, you know, more and more people just starting to say, hey, you know what, I got to take control of my own health and start to participate in these programs and change their lives so they can be off the medications, those sorts of things. So we're starting to see a positive that way. My next comment to your question, I'll see what the reaction is behind me, but I do believe that we are not able to, and the reaction from my own folks, I don't believe we're able to do a carrot or a stick sort of approach with the state of Illinois. I don't think that's allowed by the contract, but I'd have to 100% validate that for you.
That's interesting. We've worked with local communities where local school districts, local park districts
mm-hmm.
have agreed and implemented those, and it's been, the results have been incredible. Unfortunately, many people just don't have the discipline or desire to take care of themselves until that negative happens. So it's not meant to be punitive. The goal of the negative incentives is to help that individual get better to get better outcomes. And maybe
right.
that's something that we need to be looking at as a in working with these groups, because it's going to be that 5 or 10% of the problem people that are going to fight it, and even though they're the ones that would benefit from it the most,
yep.
They're the ones that aren't getting the colonoscopies that now turn into a significant problem, or the blood pressure that turns into a problem that if was forced to catch early, then those individuals could be helped. So in the private side, and you probably have the statistics, on the private side, it has reduced your health care costs. You can quantify that.
Yeah.
And maybe what we need to do is take a look at those quantified numbers versus the public side where you can't do it. And then maybe you could help us come back and tell us if some of those same incentives were in place, what kind of potential savings could we occur and get, and what kind of better outcomes could we occur if we were allowed to implement some of those types of programs that local labor have agreed to in negotiations, but could potentially help us with better outcomes in the state?
No, I agree, and easy calculation would be what your total spend overall. And earlier, I think there was a backlog of $1.6 billion, so 1% of that is a lot of money, 2% is even more money, and 3%, you know, we're talking real dollars and savings here. And to your point, the power of doing this, maybe at your different locations and your different agencies, is the power of a group. So we've worked with different local governments and different city governments and county governments in the past, and when we've been able to do a group program, even if it's just walking, the number of miles that are walked, the number of pounds that are lost, the number of diabetics that are no longer because they're on adult onset diabetes, number of them that go down, it is real. Now, the challenge has been over the years is to be able to say what exactly is that return on investment. And it's always going to vary. But I would say that with your group, you would have a return on investment that would be real here.
Yeah, and that's why, again, just quickly, on the all those positive walking programs are all good, but still doesn't help us kick those negatives. And I still remember a few months ago where I met with an employee from a local government who came in and said, you know, if I was forced to do a colonoscopy, otherwise I'd have to pay more for my health care. I had that done, and they found some cancer. I was able to get the surgery done, and I just want to say, if it wasn't for there, I don't know where I would have been. Those are the kinds of stories that the negative incentives end up saving lives in significant amounts of money, because those are the ones that won't take place. That won't get involved in those positive incentives, which would be very helpful. Same thing would be true with our Medicaid managed care. Same thing. We're not allowed to put any negative incentives to help outcomes, which if we did, we could get better outcomes as well. So we may be back looking for some of those statistical informations to help us in future negotiations. So appreciate your input.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I also appreciate the reminder I do have to schedule my colonoscopy. So, I've been putting that off, but I got to do it.
Mm-hmm. Senator Kaler?
I just can't resist. You know, where it starts, though, is in with bargaining, and we have to understand how to move into interest-based bargaining instead of the traditional adversarial bargaining. We did this with the city of Peoria. We saved over $1 million the first year because it was a partnership created, and there was a sharing of the savings of that to use for other kinds of wellness programs and benefits. But it starts with understanding that the collective bargaining process has been done horribly.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll next move to the Medicare Advantage plans, HMO and PPOs, United Healthcare, Aetna, Humana, and Health Alliance. Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Nisha Williams. I'm with Humana.
Good morning. Jeff Renzi with United Healthcare.
I'm Sinead Rice Madigan, Vice President for Government Business for Health Alliance.
And proceed with any comments you'd like to make.
Sure. Again, thank you for having us here before you today. Health Alliance has been in the Medicare Advantage program for about 3 years. We have just over 2,000 lives. We are located in 48 rural counties in the state of Illinois, and we appreciate the continued privilege of working with the state of Illinois on the Medicare Advantage program. We have no litigation or AG investigations and zero Illinois Department of Insurance complaints on the Medicare Advantage plan today.
Good morning. Thank you again. Jeff Renzi, you'll notice on the agenda Dee Dee Raybuck is listed. She sends her apologies. She became ill yesterday and was not able to travel. So I am here in her place. I'm the regional account vice president for our state and complex business. I too would like to thank you for the opportunity and the opportunity to serve your members. We currently manage and serve just over 67,000 state employee group insurance members and a total of approximately 127,000 state members in all. We also do not have any litigation ongoing. We participate in the VPP program and have been in force since February 1st, 2012.
I just want to echo my counterpart's sentiments about having us here today. Humana has been offering coverage for your retirees since February 1st of 2014. We're offered in 13 counties, and we're one of the HMO options. We have approximately 5,200 members across those counties. I am not aware of any ongoing investigations, and we are also involved with the VPP program.
Me again, Frank D'Antonio with Aetna. Again, we have about 6,800, almost 6,900 Medicare Advantage members around the different counties in the state.
So are there any issues with Medicare Advantage clients able to obtain prescriptions, consulting doctors, obtaining services from preferred medical providers?
No, I'm not aware of any issues. As an HMO, we are a network-based plan, so outside of emergency situations, our members would need to see a Humana provider.
No, sir. From United Healthcare's perspective, there would be no issue.
Mm-hmm. For Health Alliance, we are also an HMO network provider oriented plan and have not had any complaints related to access or drug coverage with employees or retirees.
And I would echo the same. I would say, going back to what we previously talked about, is what my concern is as we go forward, especially as it relates to the Medicare side. You could have one specialist in a certain county, and CMS, federal CMS, would require that you have network adequacy and or a provider in that county for, let's say, allergy or some sort of specialty that providers aren't in that county. So. If you have, you know, providers that have multiple offices, if they're not going to be able to get paid or see patients in certain areas, maybe they don't go to that one location once a week. And what that could lead to is that could lead to what I was talking about, the network adequacy piece.
Senator Kettler.
Would telemedicine help to alleviate some of that?
Telemedicine's growing, but I'm not sure if that...
It's not generally a CMS
Medicare-covered
right. service, unless you're a rural type of facility that's given special permission by the federal government. Though in the recent Balanced Budget Act that passed earlier this year in Congress, they're looking at flexibility around telehealth as it relates to Medicare beneficiaries and their access to that. There are some things you can do around supplemental benefits for Medicare Advantage members that you could potentially do, but those are things that are not necessarily in the benefit design for the state at this time.
Well, I think that whole field is going to be more and more in front of us as a legislature and in front of you as well. I think it helps to resolve some of the issues of adequacy of network.
I think that's a great point, too, and maybe we should talk to our congressman about that, because some of the areas they indicate is they don't want telehealth to supplant a provider for someone to see them in person. So use that to get around maybe network adequacy. But it's a great point.
So we heard from Aetna earlier about efforts to help patients follow the prescribed way and prescriptions and recommendations from their provider and avoid some issues. Are you having success with working with your clients and getting them to work on preventive medicine?
Overall, we have pretty good participation rates with our programs where we reach out to our membership to remind them of the medications that they need to fill. We call them gaps in care, where we're continually looking at our system to see perhaps what diagnosis might have come across, and there might not be a corresponding prescription. Like high blood pressure comes across, but there's not a high blood pressure medication. So we reach out to our membership, and we do get favorable outcomes that way.
And from UnitedHealthcare's perspective, we would echo that as well. We steadfastly reach out to the membership and attempt to close those gaps in cares, be it through a case manager or a service that we call house calls, where we will send a nurse practitioner out to the member's home, spend an hour with the member, and just kind of evaluate their healthcare in a global perspective. Our goal for 2018 is to visit roughly 38,000 members that we serve for you all in their homes this year.
HealthLine similarly has case managers that go into the home, perform telephonic case management, disease management, health coaching, depending on the diagnosis and the need of the patient, and individually creating a care plan for them as well.
Are you seeing that those efforts are paying off? What's the return?
Health Alliance is a 4-star plan out of a 5-star plan for Medicare Advantage, so we think it really is important from a quality perspective and outcomes, and our goal is to be a 5-star plan in the state of Illinois, and particularly for our state retirees. So we definitely are seeing the return on investment from the perspective of better health outcomes and meeting our quality scores for HEDIS and CAP surveys around the member surveys and response on their experiences.
We would absolutely agree. We are a 4.5-star contract for the state of Illinois as well, and truly believe that closing those gaps in care, not only for the livelihood and well-being of the member, but for the financial stability of the plan on a long-term basis, is critical.
Again, to echo what they've said, we continue to focus on meeting the members where they are and approaching them from a holistic perspective. We realize that your health is more than just your doctor's visits. So we also have programs where we go into the members' homes, we connect them with social services, and our focus is to maintain our quality scores with Medicare.
Other questions? Thank you all very much for your services. Our final panel deals with other providers, Delta Dental, Magellan, and Connect Your Care. Would those representatives please come forward? Please identify yourself and offer any comments that you wish.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak and to serve the employees of the state of Illinois. My name is JoLynn Philippi, and I am the account executive from Connect Your Care. We provide the MCAP and dependent care products to the employees. Your MCAP product is up actually 7% in enrollment. We have 15,200. And your dependent care is up 9% at a little over 2,000 employees signed up. We currently have no investigations that I am aware of, nor by the AGs as well.
Good morning. My name is Darren Avant. I'm the account manager with Delta Dental for the PPO dental plan that we administer for the state of Illinois.
Good morning. Thank you for letting us talk with a microphone. We've served the state since July of 2011. We currently have about 355,000 members on the Delta plan. We have no pending litigation at this point, and none of our providers have accepted or have elected to participate in the vendor support initiative. I'll open any questions that you have.
And good morning, Julie Billingsley, Magellan Healthcare. We administer the managed behavioral health program for the Quality Choice Health Plan, as well as the employee assistance program for the non-AFSCME Council 31 employees. And I'm happy to be here and answer any questions.
Julie, I might just start with you. Are there limits to the number of visits that clients could have under the plan that you're offering?
No, there are no limits in place for, and I assume that you're speaking of perhaps outpatient services or really any level of care. So there are no
any level.
Yeah, no, there are no maximum limits. We do manage the cases and make sure that they meet medical necessity, but there are no limits.
Are you having difficulty finding providers in various communities?
No. So our arrangement with CMS in terms of the claims is to pay claims timely, and then we are reimbursed for the claims that we processed. We did that so that we would avoid any network access issues for the members in terms of payment. So no, we've not had any issues with recruiting providers in the state of Illinois.
For Delta Dental, have you seen any change in providers asking for upfront payments, not willing to wait for VPI or other payment options?
Well, network providers are contractually prohibited from asking for any claim payments upfront, and in the rare instance that we do hear about that, we address it directly with the network provider. Non-network providers can collect money upfront. Relative to the size of the network, though, we have grown the network consistently since 2011 in every major city in Illinois, including Springfield, even with the budget impasse.
Are there other questions from members?
The VSI is fairly new for dental. Is that correct? Or have you been involved in it the whole time? Has it been offered to you?
We introduced VSI to our providers at least a few years ago.
Okay.
And initially a few providers did opt in, but then they elected not to participate, instead for them to collect the interest and hold the receivable.
Okay. And do you allow your dentist to be... to pick and choose what plans they want to cover for Delta Dental, or is it an in or out?
It is absolutely in or out.
Okay. All right, thank you.
So have you seen any decrease in the number of providers willing to participate in these programs?
For Delta?
For any of you?
No, absolutely not. We've seen growth.
Okay. Any other questions? You're getting off easy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So going back to our motion on approving the group insurance contracts for renewal or amendments for 2019, the results of our roll call were 6 members in the affirmative, but we would like to also go back and take a roll call of those members on the rolls, and note that that is still in the affirmative, that the members that have been on the roll agree with this motion. So it is declared as...
We'll just do it by leave for attendance.
Right, we're going to do a motion for leave, with leave for a attendance roll call.
Okay. Is there leave then?
No.
Very good. Then the motion has been approved. We thank you all for attending and all for your services to the employees and members of the state of Illinois.